When I was invited to speak at this service this morning, I was also given the title of my talk, "This Was a Righteous Man." Now, I wasn't told what I had to say, but quite clearly, the quote comes from the narrative of the crucifixion. After Jesus had yielded up his spirit, the centurion, the Roman soldier, who had observed all that had gone on, he made that exclamation, "Surely this was a righteous man." That quote comes from the Gospel of Luke. In the parallel passage in the Gospel of Matthew, he says, "Truly, this was the Son of God." Here was a man who had been in charge of the small group of soldiers who were delegated to carry out and supervise the execution of Jesus and those two thieves on the hill outside Jerusalem, the hill called Golgotha, or if you like, Calvary. Let us look at Matthew. We're going to observe a few of the incidents that took place there. If you don't have a Bible, that doesn't really matter. I think we are reasonably familiar with the story. I'm going to look at Matthew chapter 27 and look at the effect that Jesus' death had on a number of people. Matthew chapter 27, the first that I draw your attention to is mentioned in verse 39. "These are the people who passed by." That is, the pedestrians, the people on the street. We know that the hill was near a main thoroughfare. Some people obviously had come out to see the executions, others were just curious, I suppose. But those who saw made the comment that wasn't complimentary to Jesus. They said, "Oh, you who would destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come on, you're supposed to have extra special power. You claim to be able to do this and do that. You're going to knock down the temple and build it miraculously in 3 days. Okay, let's see some demonstration of your power. Save yourself." And of course, what they're really doing is laughing to themselves, saying, "He can't save himself. I mean, if you're the Son of God," they go on to say, "come down from the cross." So that's the way they respond to what they see of Jesus hanging on the cross. If you're as clever as you say you are, save yourself. If you're the Son of God, as you say you are, well, come down from the cross and we'll have some cause to believe you. So much for the passers-by. But you find that the Jewish leaders said much the same thing. The people from the Sanhedrin, the Jewish council, these were the ones that actually condemned Jesus to death and who then handed him over to the Romans to carry out the execution, because the Jews couldn't carry out the execution. That was only within the power of the Roman authorities. But they passed the sentence nevertheless and they handed him over. Well, they came out to see their sentence carried out. And in verse 41, the chief priests with the scribes and the elders, that is the leaders of the Sanhedrin, the leaders of the council, they mocked Jesus, saying, "He saved others, but he can't even save himself. He reckons he's the king of Israel? Okay, let him come down from the cross and we'll believe him." They've said more or less the same thing as the common people who passed by. Claims he can save others, can't even save himself. Come down from the cross and we'll believe you. You come to the robbers themselves, the two thieves that were crucified with Jesus in verse 44, and they say the same thing. So this is the third group now. All of them have the same theme. The robbers said to him in verse 44, it says, they reviled him in the same way. There is a little bit of a consolation there in that one of them changed his mind. One of the two robbers changed his mind. When you read Luke, you find after a while, in fact, get a fuller explanation, where again the man says, "Hey, look, you're supposed to have extra special power. Why don't you save yourself and us while you're at it? Again, save yourself and get us in on the act." So there was a certain amount of self-interest there on the part of the robbers. But you see, again, they were saying the same thing. As it says, they reviled him in the same way. If you have this power, save yourself. But after a while, one of them changed his tune. He saw in the behavior of Jesus and the things that Jesus said and did as he hung on the cross, he saw that here was a person who actually was the Son of God, who was innocent, who was all that he claimed to be, and he changed. And sometime during the next couple of hours, he said to Jesus, he said to the other man, first of all, he rebuked the other man, and then he said to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingly power. You are who you claim to be, and I accept it." And Jesus accepted him. He says to that man, "You'll be with me this day in paradise." But just come back to the point that I was making. You have these three groups, the passers-by, the Jewish leaders, and even those who were crucified with him, all saying, save yourself if you are who you claim to be. And when you come to verse 49, the bystanders, the crowd of people that were just standing around watching this sight, getting some sort of pleasure out of seeing people executed, they just stood around, and when they heard Jesus say something, they didn't quite make out what he said. Maybe Jesus' speech was a bit distorted because of the length of time he had hung there on the cross. He was very dry in the mouth. He used those words, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, meaning, my God, why have you forsaken me? But they apparently didn't hear distinctly. And the Eli part, meaning my God, they somehow connected with Elijah. And so they said, oh, maybe he's calling for Elijah. Let's see if Elijah will come and save him. Again, you see, and save him. In other words, this person ought not to die. If he is who he claims to be, he should be saved from this death on the cross. Four groups of people, all saying the same thing. Not only that, the soldiers themselves, the Roman soldiers, in chapter 23 of Luke, it says that the soldiers mocked him, they offered him vinegar, and they said, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourself. So there's the fifth lot. Five distinctly different groups of people all have the same thing to say. If you are who you claim to be, save yourself. If you are the Son of God, save yourself. He did not save himself, and yet the centurion says, oh, this must be the Son of God. Now do you see the irony in all that? These other five groups are all saying, if you are the Son of God, save yourself. He does not save himself, so according to their logic, he's not the Son of God. But the centurion, having watched Jesus and seen that he did not save himself, then says, oh, truly this one is the Son of God. Complete reversal. Why? Because this man responds in faith, and I think he has a much more honest assessment of what's been going on. A number of other things happen at the time of Jesus' death. We find that there was an earthquake. That's referred to in verse 54. They're all filled with awe, and they say, truly, this is the Son of God. Yeah, that's the centurion, verse 54. When the centurion and those who were with him, keeping watch over Jesus, saw the earthquake, they were filled with awe and said, truly, this is the Son of God. I think of an illustration, or an example rather, an incident earlier in the life of Jesus when he calmed the storm, the occasion when he invited Peter to walk over the water to him. He calmed the storm. It says, truly, you are the Son of God. Once again, it says they were overcome with this tremendous sense of awe. Something about Jesus in the way he did things, apart from the spectacular consequences of what he said and did, there was something that provoked awe in these people. And here it is again in the story of the crucifixion. I think it must have been the way he died, something about it, that convinced this man that here indeed was the Son of God. Jesus, it says in the parallel passage in Luke, cried to his Father and said, into your hands I commit my spirit. And having said this, he breathed his last. Into your hands I commit my spirit. In the parallel section in Matthew that we're reading, Jesus cried with a loud voice and yielded up his spirit. That, it seems to me, is why he asked for the sponge to be filled with vinegar to be put on a stick up to his lips, so that it could at least moisten his mouth sufficiently for him to articulate the words clearly and loudly so that everybody could hear. Earlier, he wouldn't take the wine when it was given as a sort of a drug to try to ease the pain. He wouldn't take that. He was going to be fully conscious and know what was going on. But he'd been on the cross now for 6 hours. He was parched. He was dried up in his mouth to the extent that his words were difficult for people to hear and understand. But he wanted to make sure that everybody understood. Everybody saw and heard clearly what was going on. And when he gets to the end and he realizes that the time has come, he has fulfilled his Father's will, the point where he yields up his spirit has now arrived. He wants to make everybody see clearly that he is not the victim of circumstances. This is not simply somebody at the end of his tether and going out with a whimper. He's going to go out with a bang. And he's going to make sure that everybody hears clearly that he is in total control. He has allowed wicked hands to crucify and slay him. And yet there's a sense in which he is in control because he has carried out his Father's will right to the end. He knows it's now complete. And that's why he asks for this moistening of his lips, of his mouth, so that at least he can announce these last few words loudly and triumphantly so that everybody standing around will hear them clearly. And they won't misunderstand this time. He wants them to hear clearly what he said. It is finished. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. I have carried out your will, brought it to completion, and now I yield myself to you. He cried with a loud voice, triumphant. And the centurion says, this was a righteous man. The RSV says innocent, and the Good News Bible says good. All of those elements are there in the word that he used. It depends which particular aspect you want to emphasize. The important thing is that his death was acceptable to God, that he died as one who was innocent, who was good, who was righteous, who had done nothing deserving death, but willingly he bore the judgment of God against sin. And having carried out his Father's will, he knows now that his death has been acceptable to God, and that's why he says to God, into your hands I now commit my spirit. Jesus knows that he has completed the work. He knows that he is victorious. He knows that he has triumphed. He died the death of the righteous. Do you remember the character in the Old Testament that said, oh, I want to die the death of the righteous? He's a fellow called Balaam. Exactly the opposite of Jesus. He was a charlatan. He was weak-kneed. He was slippery. He was unreliable. And a whole lot of other things we could say about him that wouldn't be complimentary. It's been often pointed out that this man wanted to die the death of the righteous, but he wasn't very keen on living the life of the righteous. I guess it's a fair enough comment. Here you have a man who really did die the death of the righteous. All God's righteous commands he had carried out. He had not put a foot wrong. He had borne our sins in his body on the cross. Everything he did was according to God's perfect will. The centurion comes along. He has been watching it all for 6 hours. He has seen lots of executions. He's probably supervised and helped to carry out lots of them in the past. But here is one who is different. He recognizes that Jesus was all he claimed to be. And all those other people who said, if he's what he claims to be, let him save himself, they're all wrong. And he sees that Jesus is right. I don't believe that the centurion is necessarily making a theological statement here when he says, surely this was a righteous man. He hadn't been to theological college. We probably can't read into his words all the theological concepts and nuances that you might get in, say, the letters of Paul, where he's talking about righteousness. Here was just a straight, ordinary Roman soldier, not a theologian, even though he uses what we might think is a theological word. The point is that to this man, there was this recognition that Jesus was a good man, that he was a righteous man, that he was an innocent man, and that he had the right to call God his Father. He claimed that he was the Son of God. Well, obviously, he was the Son of God. He cries to his Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and he dies. And the centurion thinks, well, God is his Father, it seems. There's something going on here. Here is a man who is the Son of God, who cries with a loud voice to his Father. His Father obviously hears him and answers his prayer on the spot. He bows his head and he yields up his spirit, just like that. If this man is the Son of God, let him come down from the cross. No way, says the centurion. If this man is the Son of God, he's proved it. He just talked to God, his Father. And here is the Son, in total control of the situation. Surely this was a good man. This was a righteous man. This was the Son of God. Goodness is very difficult to define, isn't it? How do you define goodness? Abstract idea, I guess. It's one of those things that we have trouble, I suppose, putting into words. But we understand goodness when we see it in a person. Never mind theorizing about concepts and ideas, abstract values and all the rest of it. When we see a good person, we recognize goodness. And here, this man recognized it when he saw it. Jesus Christ, suffering there, the innocent one on the cross. He knew it when he saw it in a person. surely this was a good man. And when we see real goodness, isn't it always something robust and strong and forthright? There's nothing weak or mamby-pamby about it. People have great trouble portraying goodness. People who make movies and who write books, they try to portray a good person, and they don't really quite know how to do it. A person often finishes up as a bit of a milksop or wishy-washy or rather unrealistic, too good to be true. There's not the ring of reality about it. They don't have the same trouble, incidentally, in portraying evil people, because we have a natural tendency in that direction, no difficulty whatsoever in portraying a bad person. But a lot of difficulty in portraying a good person. You see, imaginary good is often bland or colourless or a bit wet or mishmashy or sloppy or something. But real good is something strong and robust. And this man saw it in that person on the cross. Not the helpless victim of circumstances, but the Son of God, who knew what he was doing, who saw it through to the end, and when he realized that he had completed all that he had to do, with a loud voice, he cried and said, "It is finished. I commit my spirit to you, my Father." The Father hears him, and he dies. Surely, God is his Father. Surely, this one is the Son of God. This is the really good man. He dies to bear our sin. I just want to emphasize this morning one other aspect. Many of us here today are the people who would come to worship fairly regularly week after week. We are probably familiar with the truths of the atonement, that Christ died for our sin to bear God's judgment so that we might be released from sin's penalty and enjoy life with God through Jesus Christ. But the point that I want to emphasize this morning is how Jesus' death is also an example to us who are believers. Notice in the way Jesus yielded up the Spirit, although it was triumphant and forthright and loud and positive, there was nothing spiteful in it. It was a cry of triumph, but there was no gloating. Nevertheless, it did declare clearly to everybody that the sinners did not have the last word. The Jews and the Romans and those who crucified him, they did not have the last word. Christ had the last word. And of course his Father confirmed it later by raising him from the dead. He even cried, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Yes, he forgives. He holds no malice against them. He is not vindictive, he's not spiteful. But at the same time, he knows he's triumphant. He has a loud voice. He has a positive committal of his soul to God. If we are followers of Jesus Christ, we are told that we can expect the similar sort of unjust treatment as he received. Perhaps one of the reasons we are not persecuted or we do not suffer as much as we might is because we are not identified closely enough with Jesus Christ. Maybe we have accommodated ourselves too much to the spirit of the age and not shown the distinctives of Jesus Christ clearly enough to attract the sort of opposition that he attracted. Well, let me just read a collection of quotes from Peter's first letter. You needn't bother turning to them. I'll just read them to you, and with that I close. We pick up with a reference to Jesus. It says this: "You have been called because Christ suffered for you, and he gave you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin. No guile was found on his lips. And when he reviled, he did not revile in return. And when he suffered, he did not threaten, but he trusted in him who judges justly." Over into the next chapter, he asks this question to Christians: "Who is there to harm you if you are zealous for what is right?" There might be lots of people, actually. It was a sort of rhetorical question, but he goes on to say, "But even if you do suffer for righteousness' sake, you will be blessed. So have no fear of them, nor be troubled. But in your hearts reverence Christ as Lord, and always be prepared to make a defense to anyone who calls you to account for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and reverence. And keep your conscience clear." Study the way Jesus did it when he was before the Sanhedrin, when he was before Pilate, when he was before the crowd, when he was on the cross. Be forthright, be bold, be confident, but with reverence and fear, not reviling those who revile you, and not giving them a chance to revile your good behavior in Christ. After all, it's better to suffer for doing right, if that should be God's will, than to suffer for doing wrong. A bit further on, he says, "Beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery ordeal which comes upon you to prove you, as though something strange was happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, so that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. Therefore, in conclusion, let those who suffer according to God's will do right and, like Jesus, entrust their souls to a faithful Creator."